the Civil War is actually a technological war and a communication war and a commerce war. And there's a map of 1870 United States, you know, Maine, Florida, and the state, and then you make a take a map of 2020, 2021 of the bad health outcome COVID states. Same map, has not changed. We have never really ended the Civil War, and we don't even talk amongst ourselves from grade school onward about anything honest about the Civil War.
This time, our friend Tom Jennings joins the Plutopia podcast for another free-range, grass-fed conversation. We discuss Afghanistan, programming and software, Tom's Frankenrambler, racism, the Civil War, and much more.
Hey, welcome everybody to another episode of the Plutopia podcast. Our guest today is our pal Tom Jennings. And I have no idea what we're going to talk about, but I know that Tom is a technical wizard, and he is an artist, and he likes the Rambler.
Yeah, at the moment I'm kind of obsessed with it.
And we could also talk about current events, which, you know, Larry Monroe here in Austin used to say, current events are making me tense. Mm-hmm.
And I was enjoying your rant on programming languages earlier in the week.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I didn't follow up with it because it luckily petered out. I mean, my take is very old. I mean, it's a very old-fashioned take, and I am not down with the kids and large group programming. I mean, it's a new thing. It's completely different. I have no criticisms of all the approaches because I'm not familiar with them. But, yeah, it's a hell of a problem. The software's gotten orders of magnitude larger than when I wrote stuff. So, you know.
Yeah, the problem with a lot of software or any digital product is the temptation to make it better, regardless of whether it needs improvement or not. And I have products that were really great for a while, and then all of a sudden they started tacking stuff on, and it became just this behemoth.
Yeah, that's a product thing. That's a corporate product. I always got to make a new one. Nonsense.
Yeah, some people call it scale, and some people call it bloat.
A little both.
I mean, the fact is that writing software, like when I wrote FidoNet, it was fairly large, I thought. It was still a one-person project. I mean, I even wrote most of the libraries. It's interface has gotten really large, and networking has changed, and expectations have changed, and the audience has changed. Things are... You know, FidoNet at 35,000 systems was considered large, but that's nothing. It's just nothing.
I remember I was a project manager at a tech company, and I was mostly working on web projects, but these guys had like software projects too. And they were working on a software project, and they had printed out the project plan, which I think was in like Microsoft Project. And they were trying to find something on it. And this printout that they had of it was like 100 yards long. And it's like guys are standing at either end of the room holding up parts of it, kind of pointing at things and trying to figure things out.
Yeah, those are bad tools. Yeah, I mean, paper doesn't scale.
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand why they printed it out in the first place. But
yeah, well, because somebody was thinking it was the old days or something. Yeah, I was like, well, print out our listings and we'll look, you know, in green bar, lay them on the ground, find the bugs. Yeah, I mean, software is social. I mean, all software writing is social. Software is social. Software has become social. I mean, I think it's really interesting that most of what we've written for software is communication software. We've had a communication revolution, right, for the last 1,000 years, and the last 20 have been kind of crazy.
Has TCP/IP changed all that much?
I don't know. I mean, the tools, the mechanisms, I'm sure it's under continuous development. I don't know. I don't really, to be honest, I don't care. I never really got that involved. Luckily, I didn't have to get that involved to that level. That's too much. But it doesn't really matter what protocol you use, right? We have all this networking and email is a concept of, you know, above that level, above implementation level. But it took something like TCP, which was complex, IP, which was complex enough to deal with the real world, not simple enough.
Yeah, the whole change in programming that kind of drove me out of it was when it became robocode, and you could just generate these massive programs without a whole lot of effort. And I was, you know, toiling away on COBOL and in tandem mid-range programming, and that was, you know, just, you know, one guy hacking away. But when it got to where they were saying, oh, we're just going to convert all of this to Java, it's like, okay, I'm going to move to the country.
I contributed to a bunch of fairly minor in the last 15 years, nothing in the last five, but like 10 to 15 years ago. Then, you know, there's open source projects. There was some music ones. There was a program called Mix, M-I-X-X-X. Mm. It was a like DJ, turntable, blending, other stuff. I was really minor contributor to it. I was interested in using it. And, you know, it's funny, I was never been a heavy open source user, not for any ideological reason, as that it sort of came up after me. FidoNet was written by me. There was no concept of open source. There was no network to have source open on. But like a program like Mix, which I don't know, is it even still around? Who knows? Probably not. It had 1,000 contributors. That was 15 years ago. I mean, there's a core. Like all these things, the way they all work, I assume, kind of the same. There's a core that does the bulk of the work that might have had the conceptual idea in the first place. They get a thing to go. They structure the processes that get the job, to get the task done. Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, it's been around for 20 years. I should look at it again.
That was the sort of thing that I migrated to after, you know, my loss of love for programming on the mainframes and the mid-range stuff. I moved to media programming, and it's much more fun because I've always been a music geek, and there were all these people developing things that were really cool that you can do online.
Yeah, I mean, I have Ableton Live, the most recent version, up to date, and it is unthinkably complex. No one human could write anything like that. That's crazy. It's a crazy idea to even think about it. I'm sure it started off as one or a few authors. I'm just guessing, but certainly it isn't now. And Mix, just simply because I know it, and there's other projects that I contributed to that are minor. What is the most common sort of software open source contributor is all I ever was, which is, it was some really annoying bug that was bugging me personally, and I went in and fixed it. And when I'm in there, I'll spend some time. You know, I think that's the most common way people get involved in open source. They're clamoring for a feature they want, or they fix a bug that's annoying them. You know, seems to me a valid way to do it. You can't write software as complicated as Mix or Traktor, which is kind of, I assume, what it's. I'm sure anybody who's using Mix knows what Traktor is, DJ mixing software by Native Instruments. That's really good. I have a copy of that as well. It's now, I can't believe it doesn't have hundreds of contributors. It's just really complicated. And because when there's complexity, you know, if you remember that old ancient book by R.A. Brooks, I think it's by Brooks, The Mythical Man Month.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
A great book. It was a great book. I mean, it's dated now. It's ancient. It's 30-year-old history. But that points out that code writing is social activity. All code writing is social activity. The lone programmer thing it's not a fantasy. I wasn't. But even there, it really wasn't. You know, I mean, I was the sole author, but I didn't come up with all the ideas. It was probably a typical arc. I came up with all the basic stuff that really I'd cobbled together from a bunch of ideas other people came up with. And it's all written down, and I'm sure if anything I ever did from memory, it would be useless. But Andover, Sino, discussions of what if we had enough bulletin boards to make local call, town, across the United States. In 1980, it was intriguing in one sense, but silly in another obvious one. But anyways, there was some discussion in there that was cogent and interesting. And anyways, I cobbled all that shit together, and then I wrote code and made FireNet. Crap with John Madill. even though a lot of people didn't write code directly from my code pile, lots of people contributed ideas, and I just solicited ideas and then I coded them. So again, I guess we could have started an open source like thing with Echo later, but anyways, I didn't. Other people did. Nobody can do everything. By that time, I was bored anyways. By 1990, I was kind of done. Problems, people writing code today, it's all social management. and you know, Discord and Slack and all kinds of stuff used for communicating. You know, I just don't want to do it anymore. That's all. I don't think it's bad. I'm just not interested.
Oh, you mean you don't want to write code?
No, actually, I really enjoy writing code for these. Where are they? These tiny little. Yeah, they're little. There's a
Arduinos.
Well, yeah, Arduino header. There's the board is what is on the board? Well, there's an SD card, rotary encoder, some high power MOSFET stuff. There's a radio, LED driver, PIR sensor, solar panel, battery, loudspeaker, and I using SAMD51 chips. They're like little satellites. They manage their own power. They know they learn the diurnal cycle. They have a sensor when someone walks by, they play music. And they connected a self-addressing mesh network using 98 cent radios, all these obsolete radios I should stop using. But I write all that code and I make these boards that are daughter, you know, piggybacks to the big Arduino and the big SAMD51 from Adafruit. And those run my car stuff.
Yeah, you got code for the car, right? For the Rambler.
Yeah, the Rambler Roadster's got three processors in a real-time network, and it's kind of crazy. Each one of these is it, no, these aren't the boards, but they look like that. All print circuit boards look alike. There's 880 ampere MOSFET drivers on. You can't actually run 640 amperes through that little board, but it can run 4 times 20 and barely get warm. It has thermal management and all this complexity on it. But it's all that stuff was hard once. Now it's easy. So that's fun because it's all that big. It does something out there that I get to test. And if it fails, it's on me. I know I'm big on reliability. So that's fun, but that's containable. That's more like that's dilettante programming at this point.
And you're getting stuff from Adafruit?
Yeah, they're my go-to electronics. I love it.
I got Lemoore Freed and Phil Terone to speak at South by Southwest years ago. And when they came to town, one thing that they did, I wasn't there when they did it, but I heard the story. I think they modified a Roomba. I think it was a Roomba that they had. And they turned it into Frogger, and they put it out in the street in traffic and played Frogger. With a real device and real traffic.
No, I've never met Lemoore Freed. I love everything they do.
She's very cool.
She's a great big weirdo, and everything I've done has been like just wonderful.
She seems perfectly normal to me. So do you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, that's cool, and I like everything they do. They've been great from the start. I like their electronics, like their drivers. I don't really buy. I mean, I buy chips and DigiKey, and I buy modules from Adafruit and boards from Adafruit. I don't make CPUs. It's pointless for them. I can just buy them for $20 from Adafruit. That's great. And I haven't done that for about a year now because I've been obsessed with the stupid metal thing.
What is this stupid metal thing?
Can I take this camera off without making everybody vomit?
We won't vomit. We promise.
We like a thrill ride anyway.
Let me see it out there. Yeah.
We do occasionally vomit, but we try to keep it low profile.
Actually, that's a nice picture. There's the engine on the ground, and there's the...
Yeah, that looks great.
The transmission is just visible in the corner behind the other roaster.
Don't you need to put that engine in the car?
Yeah, they do tend to run a little better when they're in the car. But the reason... it's a long story. It takes a lot of work to get it rebuilt and money and time. And then I got sick. I had a nasty sinus infection that delayed things. And then I delayed choosing the transmission. I had to choose between a 61-year-old transmission and a newfangled 58-year-old transmission. And I went with the newfangled one. Then it took 3 weeks to rebuild, and that's a side story. So my friend of mine's going to come by, and we're going to stick it in tomorrow.
When you got sick, did you think you had COVID?
Well, I did think so. I mean, I went to a dance party, danced way too much, took some friendly substances. And then I took a giant huff up of somebody's vaporizer. That was a mistake because those are just terrible, evil things, that awful oil they use. My excuse was I was high. anyways, my throat felt kind of awful because those things are just kind of poisonous.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I had a series of weird things in my throat, and I thought, oh boy, did I get COVID from, you know, being stupid. You know, it was outdoors. It wasn't really, my behavior wasn't stupid, so even though it sounds marginally stupid, it was marginally stupid. Anyways, it just became opportunistic. I got a sinus infection. On the Saturday before I got COVID tested, it was negative. I didn't think it was, but you never know.
Yeah, these days, just any sniffle or cough is immediate concern.
Yeah, yeah. Then you forget that, oh, yeah, there's other illnesses besides COVID. And this is, I've had chronic sinus infections all my life. I had a surgery. Sinus surgery that pretty much cured them all. But if I work at it hard enough, I can do it, you know.
Yeah.
Dance of the 6 hours until 4 a.m. was, I think it just sort of, it was just, you know, it's hard work. It's just hard freaking work.
Well, we got vaccinated and thought we were going to be immune or something like that, and then realized that it's not immunity, it's resistance, right?
Yeah, it was.
And so
yeah,
people were getting sick.
Yeah, there's a little island of immunity, essential immunity for a short period. But yeah. So.
Yeah, now they're saying we're going to have boosters, and there's no idea yet how often you have to have a booster.
Yeah, I just go with the flow. I don't know why there's any controversy over it all. I mean, we probably shouldn't go there because we'll just get angry and yell at stupid people. to no avail. But yeah, you know. World's imperfect, as we know.
Well, people are definitely learning about epidemiology. Well, some people are learning about epidemiology and pandemics.
Or not
vaccines, kind of what vaccines can do and what they can't do. I think we're all either smarter about that or dumber about it.
Or dead.
There's a lot of people who seem to get progressively more ignorant, which is surprising to me.
I mean, it's not, we all know what it's like to be a pighead, right? No, I'm not going to change. I'm right. You know, we've all done that.
Yeah, wrong. You're not the boss of me.
Yeah, you know, and hopefully we, you know, I've learned to really, genuinely, it's one of those things you have to, as an adult, learn to get over yourself. And even if you are right, you have to consider you might be wrong. And even if you're right, you have to let other people be righter or, you know, there are all kinds of, like, and often you're just plain old freaking wrong when you think you're right. So for all these reasons, we've got to learn to be more modest and get along with people. And I've certainly taken that to heart, even though I'm flawed and, you know, as anybody. But yeah, you know, but when it, we're going to get that kind of entrenched and people won't back off, you know.
So you've always been a bit of an anarchist. I suspect that all of the weird politics that's going on now looks pretty crazy from your perspective.
Yeah, it doesn't seem really any different. It's worse.
More intense. Yeah.
There's it's interesting to discover in your own self the biases that you drag along that you think, well, you just sort of think they aren't there. You think you're being open-minded when, you know, there's nothing wrong with being biased. It's where your brain and your eyes cannot take the whole world in. The map is not the territory. You can't put the whole world in your head. It's the world. And you need to reduce it. And you need to reduce it to something grokkable. And hopefully that's one that's based upon, you know, observation and stuff. So, yeah, you know, you got to make shortcuts. So, but you just kind of know, you have to know that, well, sometimes it's just wrong or sometimes you just had it.
Yeah, there's been a lot of deja vu going on for me. Every time I turn on any kind of news broadcast, I'll hear this horrifying thing that's going on. I go, well, I remember when that happened back whenever, you know, things like having to get out of a country real fast. We remember that from previous episodes of bad government, and it was usually our bad government.
Yeah, this latest mess is pointed out. I mean, it was obvious that the pullout was probably the only choice for a thing that shouldn't have been done in the first place.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were there because of magical thinking in government. There's a lot of magical thinking going on there.
I think straight up we're there for greed. I think it was the manifest destiny, the racist white guys thinking they know everything. The assumption that places like Afghanistan need to be a country. Everybody wants to be a country, right? Everybody wants democracy or something like it, right? It's like, no, apparently, I don't know, but apparently the people who live in the Afghanistan part of the region of the world, the place that we call Afghanistan, are probably pretty happy, or whatever word you want to use, are pretty self, have decided that their tribal mechanisms, you know, we hate the people on the other side of the mountain, but we love the people on this side of the mountain. That's the one they want to live. Why should they have to be a goddamn country? It's none of our fucking business.
Yeah, I mean, I think the real problem is this assumption that if you're not like me, you're broken, and I need to fix you.
Yeah. Now, I mean, there's a naivety that we all share there that might be excusable if we weren't imposing on people by killing them. Yeah. You can roll your eyes while you listen to some, a young person or super young person, like a small child, tell you about their worldview. But yeah, at some point, well, none of these people were naive children. They did this crap on purpose. They wanted to extract resources or gain access to places with their resources, because I don't think Afghanistan's got a lot of gas and oil, but it's adjacent to its strategic bases. I think it's a place where they thought, well, these people aren't organized. They don't know what the hell they're doing. They're just a bunch of dirtbags or without any technology. Obviously, they're not very smart. obviously, all that's wrong. They're not technological, but they're not stupid. They certainly have adapted where appropriate.
Yeah. I mean, we're kind of just replaying the Crusades, right?
Yeah, in a much more rational-seeming way.
Yeah, no one seems to study. Yes.
The point, I think, was inevitable. But, what the thing that makes me the most angry, even though other people in the world will hate me for this, maybe, is like, it really never occurred to them that the Taliban and the people on the ground could complete their takeover, what do you want to call this transition, in 2 days? Okay, 2 days is fast. 5 days, a week, a month? They really thought, oh, there are just all these disorganized people that are just a bunch of idiot tribe people living in stupid tents. What do they know? They'll never get their shit together. Well, obviously, they've had 25 years minimum to understand how to make models about how the Afghanis live and work to be able to put together a model. And it seemed really obvious to me that, yes, of course, the goddamn Taliban took over the country in 2 days or 5 days.
Yeah, I mean,
what do I know about the Mideast? Christ.
I think there were people who knew that we were going to have to prop them up, or they would just, one thing that was happening is that these Afghan troops that we had been training for years and years just sort of deserted and went, over to the Taliban.
Fight? Well, it looked like they were going to stop being paid by, good old U.S. dollars. So there goes the...
It wasn't their fight. And, we bred the Taliban into existence.
Yeah. Well, the Russians made the same...
assault on their culture.
Yeah, the Russians made the same mistakes that we've made. No one... Yes. Studies history, I guess, in government anymore.
But I think there's an ideological difference. I think the Russians are better at this than the Americans are. The Russians aren't fooled, I think, by their own bullshit to the same extent. The Americans, I think, truly believe that they can go in and that every country wants democracy. Every country must have democracy. Every country will trade with us. And we can do this. It's essentially racist manifest destiny. And I think Americans still act that out. They still believe that is the case. And that's what CNN right now, it's like screaming, thinking of all the poor women. It's like, oh, you don't give a shit about the poor women. Oh, the writers do. I mean, I think the writings are, the writers and the people on the ground are earnestly as concerned as they say they are. But the system that put them into place, that did all the exploitation, clearly did not give a shit. The state of women's culture on the ground in Afghanistan and the Mideast in general is mere accessory they must deal with in order to extract whatever it is they're extracting or doing. They clearly nothing was done. And when it pulled out, all they had done was built a Taliban with a massive immune system to racist white people, gave them a huge amount of fucking infrastructure that's now worked. Even all those trucks, mundane trucks on the side of the road, the military maintained them to the top-notch condition. Those are all seized. Those will be good for 20 years without maintenance. It's a disaster. And I still think the Americans don't have it. But the Biden administration thinking that they could not predict that this would have been the outcome, this rapid takeover, because it's just so baffling that they could be so blind about something that seems fairly obvious as an outcome.
Well, I actually don't believe that they didn't predict it. I think they probably knew what was going to happen. But what are they going to say? They're going to say, well, this is going to be a mess. It's really going to, there's going to be a huge collapse and all that. You're not going to say that.
No, there's a degree in which they know that, well, okay, we're going to exit. Well, let's say idealistically, we'll get our friends out for reals now, really. And then, hey, sorry, you know, millions of women and men who we can't get out and wouldn't get out under any circumstances because we don't want you here anyways, or whatever, good or bad, indifferent that means. But I think they didn't even get their friends out. And so we know that there's going to be thousands upon thousands of people who were aligned with Americans, helped Americans, and are just going to be dead in the next few months. Luckily for them, they're anonymous and no one knows who they are. So when they die, they won't be in the news.
Well, Biden,
this was all of this was set in motion by Trump. And if anybody
was set in motion by George Bush, it was set in motion by George Bush.
No, I don't mean that part. I mean this. I'm just talking about this latest thing, this withdrawal. Trump, Trump planned the withdrawal. They agreed on it. They negotiated with the Taliban what they were going to do. And, you know, when things Trump touches kind of turn to shit.
The other thing is that
if Trump had remained president, all of this would have happened. The one thing that wouldn't have happened is that they wouldn't have been pulling all those Afghans out because they don't want immigrants coming into the USA, right?
Yeah, so no, we don't know what Trump would do, except that we know that it would be irrational, and if anything good came of it, it would be an accident, essentially.
Well, you know, actually, Obama was pushing the disengaging from Afghanistan, you know, in his...
But he didn't do it.
Everybody wanted to do it, but nobody accomplished anything.
Propping up the American state, which is part of the oil companies and large companies, Bechtel and those guys. It's the history of nation states back 400 years, starting in England. Money backing the crown. This is really not any different in kind or degree, except a larger degree. I mean, you really don't think, I firmly believe that the people who set policy in the United States at the large scale like this are corporate money interests.
Of course.
Right?
Yeah, that's driven all of our conflicts.
The hell of it is that all of us, including the three of us sitting here, benefit from all that.
Mm.
Our lifestyle, the way that we're able to live, depends on the way the U.S. has conducted itself in the world over the last, century?
That's true. However, that is not a reason for us to attack ourselves. Given a choice, we wouldn't be doing these things, or we'd be making other choices. Or at least we'd be presented with the opportunity to either be hypocrites and choose it, or say no. It's bullshit to me to even make this as a suggestion because we are in no position to choose that. And, I'm not trying to let us off the hook for anything, but we don't get to choose. We were deceived outright our entire lives. The lies have been consistent that the world, that the state and the and business works this way. These are engineered lies meant to deceive millions, and they've worked. So yeah, we are not guilty of, but we are responsible for. Right? We didn't perpetrate this. Would you have done this if anybody asked you? Would you have done these things? Of course, you'd say no. But we weren't asked. We didn't even know it was being done.
I'm not even sure what all they did. I mean, I have an idea, I know some of what they did. But, you know, it's sort of like the climate change thing. we can talk about reducing the carbon footprint, right? But if you personally start to try to reduce your carbon footprint, you find out it's really hard. What are you going to get?
Short of going completely off the grid, Ted Kaczynski style. It's virtually impossible. You can lower it, certainly, and we should, and we all do to some degree, hopefully. I know it's complicated, right? There's not a black and white set of circumstances or a black and white set of choices. And we're not guilty, but we're culpable and we're responsible.
There's no one in this mess.
But, if ExxonMobil doesn't change their tune and continues to blockade, what the hell are we going to do to fight ExxonMobil?
You know, all of our military adventures in this country since World War II, which was an actual fight against a fascist threat, have been empire building. Go and protect Korea from the commie menace that we felt was coming, and it might have been, but we also, you know, had Standard Oil of New Jersey getting us involved in Vietnam because they wanted that oil that's offshore, and that was one of the big reasons people were gathering in Vietnam and trying to take over. And so it's, you know, it's anytime you try to, you know, do the right thing, there's going to be some big corporation who's going to say, no, that goes against our business plan.
Yeah, it's not in our name and we're all involved, but we don't make those decisions. And we're not actually always aware of what's going on. And what I do think is, sort of circling back to where we started a little bit, communication media in general, and communication technology specifically, the information age, is really the crack that has opened up that is letting us see these things. You know, every mobile phone has got a camera and a broadcast network built in. Holy crap! You know, who could have thought of that 30 years ago? Holy shit!
Suddenly you find out that cops are shooting black people.
In a pattern that becomes discernible. I mean, the pattern is, it now makes perfect sense, and it's documented in various ways, back to, you know, really good Civil War docs like that one I keep raving about, telling everyone they need to read. Battle Cry for Freedom by... how's the guy's name? I should remember it. Battle Cry for Freedom. James McPherson. Best book I've read in the last decade. And it points out that the Civil War is actually a technological war and a communication war and a commerce war. And there's a map of 1870 United States, you know, Maine, Florida, and the state, and then you make a map of 2020, 2021 of the bad health outcome COVID states. Same map.
Yep. It's been that way forever.
Exact map has not changed. We have never really ended the Civil War. And we don't even talk amongst ourselves from grade school onward about this, about anything honest about the Civil War.
Oh, and in Texas, talk about slavery, and you'll have the Trumpers and, well, all the Texas Republicans going, no, it was nothing about that. And they ignore the fact that the lead paragraph of the Texas Articles of Secession say it's because of slavery.
Oh, it's slavery. It's really interesting. And then in 2018, I went to the Hot Rod Power Tour, my Roadster, it's an institution set up by Hot Rod Magazine, very self-serving, but that's fine. Just a bunch of idiots in cars driving around in hot, sweaty weather. It's all on the East Coast. And it was 2018, it was the height of Trump, you know, the Trump up ramp, Trump stickers everywhere, Trump. It's funny, in hindsight, we would know that it was Russian bot networks and all kinds of stuff amplifying crazy voices on Facebook, crazy stuff. And then I started looking at profiles of some of the ranting, raving lunatics on Facebook and noticing they have no background. They have no photographs. They had joined a month ago. The names are all generic, a couple of flags. And I realized that there's all these fake accounts. And so, like, wow, man, who knows what's going on? So I decided to go to the Hot Rod Power Tour, 6,000 mile drive. 2,500 miles away, 1,000 miles on the trip, a couple of thousand back. And anyways, on my way out, I decided not to drive interstates, which is complicated. But anyways, if you go to the Oklahoma Panhandle, the history of the Oklahoma Panhandle is that when, whatever the line was called, when they drew a line across the United States and they said, no slavery, Texas chopped its top off so they could stay in the slave states. And that top was stateless for 40 years, and it became the Panhandle, Oklahoma Panhandle. So I drove specifically through there partly for for physical road reasons, but also because I wanted to see what that crazy place was. And it was interesting. It was an interesting drive. So, you know, stateless for 40 years, there's a lot of whack jobs and slaveholders and transient criminals and stuff in there. But there was plenty of unincorporated states territories at the time for people to go. So anyways, that book is a great book. It's a really great, great, great book. It's written, with newspaper clippings, books, written accounts of all sorts. So it's heavily bibliographed and footnoted. Most of the footnotes are, you can just skip them because they're source material. After a while, halfway through the book, I said, what am I even looking at the footnotes for? supporting materials and stuff. It's a really dense and hard read, but holy crap. The at the beginning of the war, railroads were relatively new but successful. The telegram was new, cut and edge, highfalutin stuff. At the end of the war, telegram is what won the war for the Union. Telegram and train. They could deploy 100,000 people in 2 weeks.
Before, but did they win the war?
Would have been 20 years.
Apparently the war never ended.
What? No, the Civil War has not ended. It has not ended.
We used to say, save your Confederate money, the South shall rise again, as a joke.
Yeah, that wasn't a joke in Texas. You would hear that, and those guys are serious.
Yeah,
it's a joke. I was not.
And we thought they were. Yeah, we thought they were joking. Or we just didn't really think about it that much at all, to be honest. It's never been the lost cause. Is not lost in some people's mind. So we need to finish the Civil War. We have our own issues here. So I don't know.
Well, the way it's going, a lot of the people that are all, in favor of refighting the Civil War are the ones that are denying the vaccine. I mean, is natural selection going to kick in there? And
maybe. I mean, the thing is, the death rate's not that high. It's not. It won't do that job. Not that that's the way to do that job. No, the Civil War needs to be fought. I don't mean by guns in the streets and, killing each other's cows and shit. It needs to be brought up to the fore that it never ended and that we need to deal with these issues right now. The police thing, the only criticism I've heard of it that gets any traction, it's got a terrible name. The police need to be completely reorganized from the ground up. It can be done. Apparently Camden, New Jersey did it, or Newark. They need to be defunded, reinterviewed, rehired, and keep the scumbags out and make a database of the scumbags that don't get rehired as cops. Like, look at fire departments. Fire departments are largely male, though that's changing. They're macho, right? But they do community service. They provide a service to the community that is tangible and it's real. And they just don't have the, you could call a fire cop. You might get a gruff, grouchy, whatever, worst case, but they actually provide a service. The cops don't always provide service. They just have a lot of power.
That's always the problem with anything. Whoever is holding all the power, it can tend to push them over the edge to, going from being a public servant to being a despot.
Well, they're informed. What I started saying in 2018 was this, okay, the phrase law, it's right in front of us the whole time. We have this phrase, law and order, law and order, law and order. It's a TV show. We all get it. We know what law is, right? It's all written down. Even when it's bad, at least it's written down. What's order? Order is black kids driving through the wrong neighborhood at the wrong time in the wrong car. Oh, we need to pull it over to make sure they're good. And we have white friends who have black friends. And when every time they're in the car, not every time, but every week that they're in the car, they were pulled over for some excuse. When those black women were not in the back of the car, for years they were never pulled over. It's not like a little thing. It's like this. It's a huge gulf. It's a huge fucking gulf, and no one sees it except black people because it only happens to black people. And
we were told to see police as this like friendly guy here.
Yeah. Oh, it was funny. We're watching all these British cop shows. British detective shows, which is kind of retrograde and all that, but that's cool. It's interesting. The police, of course, it's idealized. And I know that if I was living in public housing and I was brown and I lived in London, they would not necessarily be having a good time. But it's interesting, the positioning of the police officers, the uniformed officers in these English shows, and I recognize it as fiction. First of all, they're wearing non-militarized jackets. They have that police kind of hat. But their vests are like blue, green, and white. They're like really dorky. They're dorky jackets. Their cars are economy cars with white and green and red, and flashing lights and other stuff. Nobody's carrying guns. They seem much more like a sort of annoying technical custodians, who I'm sure under the right circumstances can cause you a lot of grief. But that's like fundamentally their cultural position isn't like the cowboy, militarized cowboy savior. It's some personally. And then there's investigators and guns on these shows are fairly rare and not usually part of the story.
They're like the hall monitors in junior high. That's basically.
Hall monitors, if they're bullies, in the right circumstance can be truly awful. And yeah, I don't mean to downplay what might
but
happen.
But at least you're not carrying rocket-propelled grenades or something.
Yeah, yeah. Or shoot first, gasp later, you know. Yeah, yeah. Anyway, so yeah, that trip out to the Southeast was interesting. I did see a lot of Trump stickers. Everybody was nice and polite. And we managed to cover, it's like the 7 days. So basically, you rent a lot of motel rooms. You have to plan it out. It was an interesting trip. Went from Bowling Green, Kentucky, down to Alabama, Georgia, Atlanta, and up to North South Carolina. Darlington, I think, was the last. Darlington, South Carolina, was the last racetrack. And it went from racetrack to racetrack to racetrack. And there was the usual kind of car show crap at each one. And the caravan that went from city to city. I was one of the few people that went all 7 days through all cities, and I was by far the person who came the furthest. Everything was on the East Coast. And rarely did we see Black people all driving to the South. I mean, it's interesting. They pick these routes to relatively small towns, because it's a cruise, right? So you want to have a nice drive and stay off the interstates. So I drive to all these small towns, and there was Black people here and there, but for the most part, it was white town. We got through Whitesville and Whitesboro and Whites this and Whites Corner and Whites. Except in Darlington, where the Darlington racetrack is in the middle of Darlington town, which is the middle of Black neighborhood. It was abundantly the dirty, filthy racetrack in the Black neighborhood containment was. But it was also simultaneously really friendly and endearing and goofy. Everybody was really nice. It was the power tour when it comes through is kind of like a parade. It's like, because they're all car nuts. The South is all car nuts. So there'd be these families at the end of the driveway, with this long house set way back and all this grassy front yard with flags and lawn chairs and waving at all the cars. And it was fun. It was a pretty fun crowd at the same time. I had a pretty swell time. It was very sweaty.
Yeah, your observation about not seeing a lot of Black people, and then that whole area, and the area John and I grew up in, was the same way. There was legislated, Black people live over here, white people live on this side of the...
Yeah, they were on the north side.
On the other side of the tracks. And so it was not the prime real estate where people of color were living. White folks had the nice hillsides and nice lawns, and across the tracks was pretty subsistence living there, and you'd see that through all these towns because that was done during the days of slavery, and it hasn't changed all that much. Austin was set up that
economic,
way.
Yeah, then there's a general economic, and some of it I wouldn't say it's natural, but it does fall out of economic systems that the poorer people live in the poor places. Richer people don't. Again, select better. I mean, it's just that mechanism on top of it that probably exists everywhere, but it kind of needs to be fought against, right? I mean, there are, when I was there in 85 and 87 in Netherlands, there were drunk bums living on the street, but the proportion of them was microscopic and they kind of had to work at it a little bit. If you work hard at anything, you could accomplish your goals. And if you want to drink yourself to death for whatever reasons, you can accomplish it. But we live in social systems that need to take care of each other better, and we're not very good at doing that.
Well, we don't necessarily accommodate diversity very well in many parts of the country. I mean, as we were saying, though, I recall that when I was in high school, my senior year, we moved to Odessa, Texas, and I went to Permian High School, which is the high school that Bissinger wrote about in Friday Night Lights. And it was all white, except there was one Cuban girl, as I recall, and everybody else was white in that high school, which was different for me because in Big Spring, where Scoop and I grew up, we had one high school and, you had everybody there. But by the time Bissinger wrote Friday Night Lights, there were a lot of Blacks going to Permian High School. I don't know exactly what changed, whether there was a demographic shift, whether people moved, more Blacks moved into those neighborhoods.
Well, they learned that they could get a winning football team even more so, and that's what happened.
Well, that was it.
Happened in Big Spring got integrated because they realized that the really great football players were all over at the black high school, and they closed that and brought them in, and suddenly they had a better football team, and that was the big equalizer.
Did we have a black high school in Big Spring? I thought all the blacks were going to Big Spring High.
No, not until my first year in high school was the first year it was integrated. There, the Northside High School, I forget the actual name, but that's where all those folks of color were made to go to school.
And and kids weren't generally the problem either. There were not many black people in our town, but we were friends with some of them. We hung out. We knew that they were black. It was abundantly obvious. And we joked about it sometimes even, but as high school kids, it didn't really operate in any tense way. I think a lot of it is learned later in in workplaces. Because the kids I don't think kids are naturally. They might be like, oh, you're different from me. I've never seen anyone who looks like you. And because, kids are so straightforward. And that's not bad. That's perfectly fine. Why do you look different from me? Your hair is funny. I don't know. Your hair is funny to me. Well, it's not funny. Well, let's go play. Whatever. Who gives a shit? Let's go play and chase the dog or something. But you learn it and parents encourage it and schools and workplaces enforce it.
Racism is taught. It's not something you're born with.
No, I think it's played out. Like there's not a fear of other, but at least a notice of other. Like, because you go through the world, you taxonomize everything. Like, all those things that go like this, those are trees and they have leaves and all trees are kind of like the same. And then as you get older, you realize that all trees have all these different taxonomies and some here like that. And so with human beings, it's like, well, everybody in my family looks like me. Big surprise. Wow, that person looks really different. That's cool, but or that's just whatever. And that's perfectly reasonable for a 1, 2, 5, 10-year-old to remark on, right? I mean, yeah, they do look different than you. What's the big deal? Because a lot of American anti-racism stuff used to be, not so much anymore, I don't see color. It's like the only solution I can imagine to racism is to not see black people or whatever, is to think is to make everybody like me, the lathe of heaven solution. Make everybody the same. Whereas there's no, difference is good.
Yeah, exactly.
All difference is good. I mean, not all of it's to your liking all the time, but a lot of the difference is perfectly good. God, if I had to eat only white people food, shit, I would have starved to death years ago. Damn.
Well, and that's why I think, different cultures should be prepared to, assert a cultural identity. I mean, you shouldn't have to adapt to a surrounding. We should be able to accommodate. You remember the idea of the melting pot, the United States is the melting pot. Well, that kind of the idea there was that everybody would kind of become the same, but really that's not what it should be. It should be more like the multicultural thing where all the cultures can coexist, but they can have their cultures can be preserved as well.
There's adaptation paths that seem to get followed. Like someone who was an immigrant pointed out and said, all immigrants are here sort of against their will. Even the ones that are voluntary, like the relatively well-off Chinese kids who come here to be students, they're disrupting your lives in a giant way, right? They're going to a place where the culture's alien. Some of them they don't like, et cetera, et cetera. God, I forgot what I was going to say.
There are some who want to emulate
the immigrants, the younger ones who move here physically as teenagers to adults, they learn the local language at least well enough to get a job, right, and survive. And they're usually driven people and, make things work. Their kids learn the language, right? They're essentially full immersion, right? The grandparents basically never learn the language. So there's this, I'm grossly oversimplifying, but the people who came here learned the language and have a thick accent, and you can hear them. Their kids become multilingual and are fine. And that generation becomes the melting pot version of, they take a Chinese or Mexican identity and just mash into the complicated mess that is America. And at times when it's good, that's wonderful.
But my experience has been that I've known people who were immigrants to the U.S. who really wanted to sort of adopt the U.S. culture, whatever they thought it was, who thought it was cool to be here and thought that there was, they had bought the land of promise, land of equality, democracy, that sort of thing. And And they didn't necessarily reject the culture. They didn't necessarily adopt it completely either, but they were certainly kind of friendly to it.
Yeah, you go along with what, you know, if I moved to Mexico, okay, now I'm 66, so it would be different. But if I moved to Mexico and I was 36, I'd remain an American in Mexico. I would certainly assimilate to a lot of things. Otherwise, I'd have a really unpleasant time in Mexico. I'd just be having an unpleasant time because nothing's American there. Or, you know. So, yeah, you know, that's fine. And, yeah, it's complicated.
You know, the interesting thing that's happening here in the U.S. is that we are starting to have a majority non-white population. You know, we're moving in that direction. And apparently, a lot of this weird, like, proto-fascist bullshit that we're seeing is a reaction to that, that there's people who are really having a lot of anxiety about the idea that they may be living in an environment where whites are a minority. And they're trying to assert the white power, you know?
Well, that's why all the voting shenanigans are going on all over the country, trying to make it more difficult for any people of color or any people of conscience that, you know, that want to vote, to make it a lot harder.
Yeah, I mean, but I think the information revolution, which we certainly are undergoing in the 20th century, starting with, well, you know, you can't really pick a starting point. It's silly, but I'll just pick one because I like electricity. So the telegraph, I'll just start there just for stupid reasons. You know, before the telegraph, to get a message to another city, you had to walk or ride a horse there, and it would take hours or maybe days. Then you could do it in seconds. I mean, it's an unbelievable change in culture. And now we have that times a thousand. And I think, when I was a kid and later, it was like going to gay clubs and stuff, there was real underground culture. You know, undergrounds were enforced through all kinds of mechanisms, but mostly they were enforced by ignorance. Ignorance, not stupidity. I mean, ignorance, like we just didn't know who else was around or how to get in touch with them. All the signaling was done through fashion, gestures, words, all that kind of stuff. This is semi-universal, right? Just human culture. Electronic medium, kind of, my first observation was that it ruined subcultures. It kind of did in punk and all the stuff we played, that you and I and us, literally the three of us played with in the 90s with Boing Boing magazine and early Wired and Wanda 2000 and designer drugs and, you know, all rave music and all the kind of fun UFO punning. It was like that was a subculture forced together out of components. And then the whole concept of subcultures has gone away. And so a lot of our myths of how the world worked were ruined then. And for those of us who were on the shitty end of all the mainstream sticks, that ruination was all good, because as everyone who had a gay neighbor found out that, oh, my gay neighbor, homosexuals are all child molesters, or child molesters are all homosexuals. And you find like, oh, it's my neighbors, or it's Uncle Jim. It's like, oh, they're boring. That's right. They're not whatever. That the information revolution has benefited weirdos, largely.
That was the Fringeware premise.
Yeah, but the information revolution has specifically harmed those who are trying to maintain the status quo that was based upon worse and horrible lies used to control people. Right wing is not done well with an information revolution because their bag of shit is revealed to be a bag of bigoted religious bullshit. Meaningless, harmful, divisive, racist, bigoted, theft-based culture. Fuck those people. And their ruination is our communication revolution.
Yeah, but they seem to be leveraging the communications revolution, social media.
Look, they're always playing
catch
up.
Effectively.
They don't get it. They don't understand it. Look at all the right-wing assaults on social media. They're all trying to keep water over a dam. They're trying to hold things back that are done deals. Look at all the Getter and all their... I signed up the Getter and poked around. Have you? I assume everyone has. You should, because it's meaningless. You'll be done with it in 10 minutes. It's like a shell of a bunch of angry white guys, and they're all angry at the loss of their world, because their world existed only when it was bounded by the physical violence that they could inflict upon people to prevent queer people from hanging out in the fucking street and in a cafe, or black people coming out and hanging out with the weirdo kids doing, making a dance club out in the desert. That's where the power lines are drawn. Those power lines are being destroyed right under their noses with electronic communication technology. And I am glad that I helped take them down.
Yeah. Before the whole, you know, communications revolution that we've seen, media was very small. There were three or four networks, and they were all controlled by the same people. And a lot of those conservatives and bigots and racists were running the media. You know, if you remember how it was then, but when it expanded and there were more people of all, you know, walks of life, you know, doing media, you know, it was a lot harder to hide the fact that, you know, you're full of shit, you know, in the stuff that you're saying on your newscast.
And yeah.
That's, I mean, what's like, happened with Fox, because they stand out. I mean, it's obvious who the bad guys
yeah.
are.
Now, like, the thing is, it's always been, since the dawn of, you know, all large-scale communication systems, even Pony Expresses, telegraph systems, radio, and television were highly expensive, complex, difficult to operate technological infrastructure, right? Right? It took, you know, an AM radio station was a gigantic undertaking.
Expensive
and so
one.
They were tended to be. Like printing presses 400 years before were themselves complicated technological things run by churches and institutions and state and stuff. So, yeah, they were all gateways. But, like, look, but books... The printing press leaked out, like this. Oh, it was another great thing. Great novel, absolutely great novel. Q by Luther Blissett. I cannot say how much that book has changed my life. Holy crap, is it good?
That's supposed to be the source of QAnon, isn't it?
No.
Somebody said that whoever started QAnon had read Luther Blissett. They thought. They assumed that.
Other than the letter, it's about state systems, and no, it's a really okay. complicated novel. It's a great novel, but what it appears to be, it's funny. I got halfway. It's an amazing and engaging book, and halfway I didn't really get what the book was about until halfway through. It's not what it appears to be on the surface. It's just absolutely an amazing book. Basically, it's about the disruptiveness of the printing press. And it was the disruptiveness of the Bible being printed in German, not Latin, because Latin was the private language of the church and maintained power that way. But German could be read by mere peasants, and that was not going to happen. It did happen, and it caused major revolutions throughout Europe in a way that I didn't have enough background to understand all that stuff. Yeah, it's a great novel. So the communication technologies are inherently disruptive. And what they just, even though it's funny, there's like a paradox. They're built by something like a state. They're built by a powerful entity that must align with the state in some way or the other to continue to exist. Churches, big businesses, guilds, you know, whatever. Yeah. So they think they're going to be a gateway. So a lot of that book is about them trying to gateway who can print and what can press. Of course, the printing press is just as soon as you see one, you go, oh, yeah, I know how to make one of those things. Shit, and people made printing presses all over the place. And they were out of control, and the church tried to control them. And they were printing unauthorized works. And it was highly disruptive, the powers to be. And so communications as disruption is the key to success of getting all these things out. What does the Taliban not want people to know? They don't want women to know that if women can control their bodies and are educated, they can have actual lives and make everyone's lives better, including the children and their menfolk. So, yeah, communication technology is the center of the goddamn war. It's the center of the war. And the technology doesn't really matter what it is. You know, stack of Post-its, paper, Pony Express, telegram, radio, TV. The interesting thing about the internet is it has a structure, an infrastructure even larger and more ponderous than anything ever built before. But what it does is move packets around. It's kind of agnostic in its way. And the complexity moved out to the edges, you know, in the fringe in this thing right here in front of us, where we get to use it as kind of a pipe. And so here we are talking about the machine that's trying to kill us in a way that's kind of undermining the machine that's trying to kill us. And that's good for business, or so far it has been. So that's why it's, you know, that's why it's thrived. I don't know. I mean, I don't know why U.S. hasn't tried to suppress it, but I guess the right wing does, right? The right wing doesn't want us to do this stuff. They want to they have all kinds of hilariously crazy, ridiculous ideas about controlling social media and what the First Amendment means. They have, it's because, I think they're not stupid. They know how the First Amendment works and what it means. They just don't like it. They don't want us to do it. You know, tough luck.
Yeah, you can always tell.
They do want free speech, but they want free speech for them.
They don't want free speech. They want controlled speech. They don't want any. They want the freedom to say what they want and tell me that I can't do it.
Yeah, right.
That's not. Yeah, they use the phrase free speech, but it really means is I want to control what you're able to say. And directly, all of their assaults on social media are precisely that. They say you can't stop me from saying these blatantly illegal and factually incorrect things. But all these other people, I need to be able to take them down because they're harming my opinion. Like, my words are just as valuable as your words. Like, trying to get in this place where they just argue, well, you know, words are just words, so a word can mean anything I want. And, you know, facts change and science doesn't really, you know, it's like, it's all hand-waving distraction.
I hate to be one to suppress your speech, but we have, we have reached the end of our hour.
We're being oppressed.
You got me all pissed off. I got to go calm down.
Oh, no. Well, hold that energy. We'll come back and do another one.
Okay. Well, yeah.
Thanks
nobody,
so
really,
much
yeah.
for. Yeah, I mean, this has been great.
Yeah. No. Communication technology is like. That's the. If we got nothing else. We got each other.
Right on. Thanks, cool. Tom.
All right. We'll see you guys.
Okay,
thank you.
We'll see you soon, done. Man.
Ta-ta.
Adios.
Over and out.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.